Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday, 13th August, 1985. Venerable lady and fellow wayfarers in the Dhamma. In yesterday's talk, it was said that all of us who are caught in the coils of dukkha do not know virtue in its positive, stainless nature. But we do know what is unvirtuous, the ill state expressed in the faultiness of our daily life. This was clearly seen by the Buddha. Moved by compassion, he poured out the healing waters by which we could be cleansed and healed, namely the way of which the essential factors were samasati and samasamadhi, perfect mindfulness and perfect communion, which is meditation. The practice of mindfulness is, as it were, meditation in its prenatal stage. Biologically, life begins as a single fertilized ovum. In about 8 weeks, the embryo, now called the fetus, only 1 inch long, already has most of its tissues and organs and well-developed hands and feet, and is definitely recognizable as a human being. In about 10 lunar months, the fully grown fetus bids farewell to its limited and safe old world, and, helped by a gentle thwack from the midwife to start off its breathing, vociferously introduces itself to its new world. Thereafter, this neonate lives. Because, unless some serious mishap has militated against its survival, the whole organism has been well prepared for living. Not well, it lives. You can help it to continue to live by doing the needful for its continuance, but you cannot teach it to live. It just lives. This living is a miracle. It is not like a technique which can be learned from a skilled teacher. Meditation is just like that, but with some differences. What starts you off on the meditation track is usually pain or misfortune or deep sorrow, your psychical father. And your passionate longing, which brooks no denial, to find the cause of it and to heal this wound before you die, this passion is your spiritual mother. So it is not the marital ecstasy of two other human beings, but your own psyche and the universal transcendent creative power of mind embodying the eternal law, the Dhamma, permeating you, the living organism, which produce the first germinal thrill of the consciousness of transcendence vibrating in the golden womb of the infinite eternal. This thrill of consciousness is constricted by all the worldly influences playing upon it, so that it continues to function as vijnana, simply as discriminative, analytical, separative and isolative consciousness. But it holds within itself the full potentiality of evolving to its culmination as Vinyanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam, holistic consciousness. The bud which begins as the worldling can flower into the perfected Holy One, the Samma Sambuddha. In very rare cases, you are born with a religious consciousness showing signs of waking up, just as a poet or a composer is born, not made. And then it can grow into the holistic consciousness more easily in this very life and be the light that lights the whole world. Thereupon, your whole organic life in the world of thought and feeling, word and deed is the manifestation of a ceaseless meditation. Just as the neonate, the newborn babe, lives, even so you meditate. No one can teach you this. You and meditation have grown and fused into a single unity, and through you, the existential being, transcendence manifests its transcendent nature as the perfect human. All that you learn and practice here as meditation is really a practice in mindfulness, the within the womb stage. All our true and venerated teachers of meditation are our skillful midwives, and perhaps I should also say mid-husbands, helping us to be reborn as spiritual babes who could mature into Samma Sambuddhas when we become self-enlightened by our own union with the Dhamma. The Buddha said he was the Dhamma Bhuta, the Dhamma become. Two of Gotama's midwives were Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta. The final enlightenment emerged out of the activity of his own Buddha nature. So too it has to be with us. Do remember that the living process of your organism, the Nama Rupa, the mortal existential being, is the path. Consciousness from its vinyanic stage to its holistic fruition is the traveler through that path. Vinyana is an ever-changing khanda, composing you the separate person and functioning through you the existential separate mortal. But holistic consciousness is the eternal truth, Dhamma, deathless, infinite, not your personal property. It is the trackless Tathagata. Whereas our organism comes into being as the result of our parents' desire and procreative activity, without our personal consciousness, vinyana, working for it, vinyana plays a major role in the realization of sambodhi. In fact, the emergence of vinyana and its transmutation in our own ecstasy, not ecstasy, into holistic consciousness is the whole story of the cosmic journey, cosmic for us humans, from fertilized ovum to Samma Sambuddha. Samma Sati is the linchpin of the perfect endeavor, Samma Vayamo, to live religiously, which culminates in Samma Samadhi, the perfect emergence into transcendence. Lying on his deathbed, the Buddha said to the wanderer Subhadra, "I was 29 when I renounced the world seeking after the good." For 51 years, Subhadra, since I went out, a pilgrim have I been through the wide realm of Nyaya, method or truth or system, and law, Dhamma. This supremely enlightened one said to his bhikkhus in the township of Kammasadhamma, O monks, there is only one way leading to the purification of beings, for the overcoming of griefs and sorrows, for passing beyond all sufferings and miseries, for obtaining the right method, for realizing Nibbana. It is by the fourfold Satipatthana, the application of mindfulness to the body, the feelings, the general state of consciousness or mind at a given moment, the citta, and for the mental contents of that state. Essentially, sati is bare attentiveness by the receptive mind. It is often linked with sampajanya, clear comprehension, or being clearly conscious. Sati as bare attentiveness is a bare registering of the facts observed without reacting to them by deed or speech or thought in any way whatsoever. It is without judgments or evaluations or reflection or comments. Should comments arise, pay bare attention to them without pursuing or summarily dismissing them. Simply make a mental note of them and walk on. Bare attention is a necessary first step for enabling us later on to see the fact as the fact, to see things as they really are. This frees us from our inveterate habit of looking at everything from the viewpoint of self-interest, which always distorts our perception. Persevering practice will throw light on the actual nature of our own psyche, without which self-knowledge cannot be obtained, and it will also help the searching mind to gain lucidity and penetrative strength, that is, to see in greater depth. Through direct confrontation with the fact of ceaseless change, we will see truly that impermanence, anicca, characterizes the entire universal process. So we see that death is Lord of all manifestation. At the same time, without death, there is no rebirth. Death is the changing point, the critical changing point of the what is at this particular moment into the very next state, the next moment. So don't regard death with terror. Hence there is dukkha and the fear of death, because we don't know that it is the indispensable means for growth, for change, and so on. In due course, we see the fact of anatta, the absence of permanent, separate, identifiable entity in all that constitutes the existential being, the perishable mortal being. For every entity is a separate manifestation which of necessity is born and therefore has its lifespan and therefore dies completely as that entity. Much, if not most, of our suffering is due to ignorance and stupidity, heedlessness, rashness, and lack of self-discipline. The practice of sati would teach us to look before we leap, to pause and to be circumspect before plunging into foolish action through hasty decision. Thus we learn to live thoughtfully, considerately and peacefully in the immediate present without being disturbed or swayed by the past or future, that is, by useless regrets about the past or by silly, futile daydreams, fantasies or health-destroying fears about the future. Calm, penetrating observation of all our fantasies reveals very accurately just what our psyche is like. All fantasies are self-centered, rooted in greed, fear, ill will, and delusions. And the revelation of what we really are can give us a severe shock, sometimes beyond bearing. But keep cool, for this is a heaven-sent opportunity for a very necessary spring cleaning of the psyche, productive of great good in all respects. Watch every fantasy very intently, especially if it is concerned with lustful desire for pleasure, possessions, power, or sex. See it very clearly for exactly what it is, but see it without letting the seeing become a means for indulging mentally in what cannot be obtained or enjoyed factually, or for hurting or overpowering a person or situation which is hostile or harmful to you. The former will only increase lustful passion and lead to self-deprecation or self-hate, the latter to sliding more easily into an even more violent fantasy. In either case, there will be frustration and depression, loss of health, and perhaps even of sanity. Also, there could be repression. But whatever is forced down into the well of the subconscious only increases its explosive power. The power of the unconscious derives from man's belief in its strength. That is, its strength is proportional to his ignorance and illusion. I'm using the word unconscious here in the sense of that which is repressed and forgotten, so to say. This dragon of the unconscious is only a mass of triviality in ordinary meditation, if you practice it, and these elements from the unconscious come up to the surface, to consciousness, you see, you will discover that most of them are just utterly trivial, stupid things. If you are fearless and see clearly that it consists of all that is not fully worked out mentally and physically in daily life, your sword can be thrust right into this dragon's heart. So, watch disinterestedly, steadily, and unflinchingly till you have fully understood all that you are watching, till there is no leftover in connection with it, no substrate for another jati, that is a conditioned state as Buddhism presents it, no vasanas as the Upanishads put it. Thus, your sleep is undisturbed by dreams, your waking state is free of daydreams and fantasies, and you are free of evil psychical states. This disinterested, steady watching is pure choiceless awareness. Choiceless because you do not take sides with any of the elements composing that which you are watching. Where there is choice, there is partisanship, which expresses separate selfness. It leads to a refusal to see another aspect, to a rejection of some part of the whole. Hence, one cannot see the whole truth, the fact in its complete state. Therefore, there cannot be full understanding, and without full understanding, there cannot be perfect purification. And a true healing, a whole making of the psyche. Sati has to be samasati, perfect mindfulness, perfect watchfulness. Then there is holiness, indispensable for samasamadhi. In the discourse to Chunda the novice, a brother of Sariputta, the Buddha, detailing the nine things of which the arahant is incapable, declares that the arahant is incapable of taking a wrong course through partiality. This steadfast, disinterested looking, which is choiceless awareness, may be not only observation which is cool, but also coldly intellectual, somewhat heartless. Now the cold glare of glazed eyes does not heal. Bare attention, the intellectual part, enables me to diagnose the situation. Having seen the fact, I must not only offer no resistance to it, but I must also let it enter into my being and be absorbed compassionately by my psyche. The world and I are one. This compassionate absorption is the healing power. If the diagnosis reveals an ill, it is transformed into the well. If it reveals what is good, it is transformed into the better and healthier, for there is no end to betterment. The united action of bare attention and compassionate absorption spells true understanding. We may call it loving wisdom or wise love. Watch a mother in whom motherliness is strong. How she understands her infant. Animals too display at their level of development and in their own wonderful way this understanding for their young. Have you watched a gorilla's skillful tenderness? An object lesson to many a human being. The practice of bare attention and compassionate absorption by our own psyche is sadly lacking in the upbringing and education of almost all the members of the human species, with tragic consequences. Every parent, every teacher, and everyone who holds a responsible, controlling position in the world should consider this very seriously. We here should note that beautiful statement in Psalm 119, verse 34. Give me understanding, and I shall keep thy law. Yea, I shall observe it with my whole heart. This understanding is the fruit of samasati, which enables us to keep the law, the Dhamma, with our whole heart. Compassionate absorption by the psyche is a warm, intimate, intensely sensitive, feeling observation, devoid, which transcends all emotion, all sentimentality. Here I am not using the word feeling in the meaning of Vedana in Buddhist psychology, where it signifies only pleasant, unpleasant, or indifferent sensation of mental or of physical origin. If we regard bare attention as the mental counterpart of the bodily use of sight, feeling is the psychical counterpart of our bodily sense of touch. This psychical feeling observation plays a much greater part in our lives than cool intellectual perception, especially in human interrelationships and in the decisions we make with regard to a course of action. For example, we say, "I feel he is kindly at heart despite his outward gruffness." Or, "This proposal for our business sounds a good one, but I feel it will not work out profitably." Or, "I feel the quieter lady is more suitable for this post." This feeling is an innate sensitivity possessed by most people. Assiduous and proper practice of mindfulness opens the eye of wisdom and strengthens the heart of love. The field of mindfulness is the whole of our daily life. Recall the Buddha's affirmation that it is the only way for our purification and our release from dukkha and for realizing Nibbana. The whole of the treading of the Eightfold Path is involved in it. Mindfulness covers the waking state as well as the sleeping state. When we have some problem, we sleep on it. On waking up next morning, we are sometimes greeted with the solution of the problem. In the Mahasatchaka Sutta, soon after the Buddha said that he constantly abides in the Shunyata Phala Samadhi, which is the fruit of voidness, Agnivesana asks, "Does the good Gotama sleep during the day?" The Buddha answers, "During the last month of the hot weather, after returning from the alms gathering and eating the meal, having laid down the outer cloak folded into four, mindful and clearly conscious, I fall asleep on my right side." You'll find this point brought out in several Upanishads. Agnivesana then says, "But this is what some recluses and Brahmins say is abiding in confusion." The Buddha assures him that this is not so, explaining that it is those who have not got rid of the cankers and defilements and who are subject to confusion or bewilderment, but not those who have got rid of them. There is a peculiar problem in connection with bare attention. When we register what we watch, we believe we are registering accurately, when in fact we are not, especially in the early stages. An English man of letters expressed this delightfully. He thought he saw a banker's clerk riding on a bus. He looked again and found it was a hippopotamus. So it behoves us to look again and again, to watch steadfastly and perseveringly when we practice sati. Another problem is the wandering mind. Whilst attending to one thing, the mind wanders away to something else. Contrary to what most people will tell you, I say, do not compel the mind to return to the object of attention, the original object of attention. Attend carefully to the intruding object, which quite often is the back chatter from our own brain. It will be very self-revealing, for the mind tends to wander to where one's treasure lies. This treasure usually is but the tinsel of worldliness. Depending on one's age, it may be the girl or boy or a particular sport or source of pleasure or excitement during one's adolescence. Making money or achieving an ambition or scoring a success in self-assertion during adulthood and middle age, etc. Whatever it is, watch calmly and intelligently. The original object of attention may come back to mind after a time. As your skill in practicing sati grows, you will be able to work out fully whatever you are watching. Thus it is that the psyche is emptied of all its clutter and becomes unobstructive and transparent to the light of transcendence. Pure mind can then function freely through you, for the purified psyche is void of all ill. Free of all its conditioning by natural evolution and by society, and is at last one with the universal mind, and itself is mind. You remember yesterday I said, we do not have a mind. We have a psyche, but no mind. Just as we have no soul, The term my atma or my soul or my spirit is nonsensical altogether. You can't split up the infinite and the eternal into little bits and stick your nameplate on it. Sati, culminating as samasati, is the pure meditative state. Silent, still, speechless and thoughtless. For thought, psychically, depending on sense functioning and brain activity, and using language as its tool of expression, is simply inaudible speech. We can gauge the importance the Buddha attached to the function of speech by deep consideration of his teaching about speech in the Chulahattipadopama Sutta, and also in the Brahmajala Sutta, in the section which he calls the trifling minor details of mere morality. His exposition of the first four silas in the Chulahattipadopama Sutta occupies 30 lines of print, of which 20 deal with speech. And in the Brahmajala, printed in a slightly larger type, ...42 lines, of which 27 deal with speech. Here is Rhys Davids' version in the Digha Nikaya. He is speaking about himself, and he says, putting away lying words, Gautama holds himself aloof from falsehood. He speaks truth. From the truth he never swerves. Faithful and trustworthy, he breaks not his word to the world. Gautama holds himself aloof from calumny. What he hears here, he repeats not elsewhere to raise a quarrel against the people here. What he hears elsewhere, he repeats not here to raise a quarrel against the people there. Thus does he live as a binder together of those who are divided, an encourager of those who are friends, a peacemaker, a lover of peace, impassioned for peace. It's very rare for the Buddha to talk in such strong terms. A speaker of words that make for peace. Gotama holds himself aloof from harsh language. Whatsoever word is blameless, pleasant to the ear, lovely, reaching to the heart, urbane, pleasing to the people, beloved of the people, such are the words he speaks. Putting away frivolous talk, Gotama holds himself aloof from vain conversation. In season he speaks, in accordance with the facts, words full of meaning on religion, on the discipline of the order. He speaks at the right time, words worthy to be laid up in one's heart, fitly illustrated, clearly divided, to the point. Consider carefully that by far the greater part of our life, thought, feelings, fantasy, knowledge, cognition, communication, concepts, percepts, comprehension, insight, experience, action, etc., all involve speech, whether inaudible or audible, spoken or written. Every single one of us makes a speech, short or long, when we are born. The creation of the cosmos is attributed to the word. Om in Hinduism, the Ahuna Vairya in Zarathustrianism, the Ma'amar or creative fiat of Elohim in Judaism, the Logos of Hellenistic theology in the Trismegistic writings, the word in St. John's Gospel, and the Rig Vedic hymn to Vak, the goddess of speech, magnificently presented the height and depth of speech, sublime, splendid, simple. How significant is that sentence in the Avastha with regard to Zarathustra, spoken by the holy immortal Vahumana, the divine mind. He is eager to proclaim the glory of Mazda, wisdom, and his eternal law in songs of praise. So, let him be granted sweetness of speech. What can we say of our use of speech? For the whole world talks incessantly, except in deep, dreamless slumber. Even the most superficial observation shows that one of the most tiresome disturbances in everyday life is constant chatter, inconsequential, useless, mischievous, noisy, seductive, frivolous, harmful chatter, a pestilential nuisance and perhaps the most powerful obstruction to living mindfully in communion with transcendence. The Buddha classed the following items as low conversation or frivolous chatter: talk about kings, ministers of state, robbers, war, terrors, battles, foods, drinks, clothes, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives and relationships, equipages, villages, towns, cities, countries, tales about women and heroes, gossip at street corners or wells, ghost stories, and if he lived today, he may have added love stories and detective novels. Desultory talk, speculations about the land and the sea, or about becoming or not becoming thus or thus. So spake the Buddha. To this day, the bulk of the world's talk is about food, drink, pleasures, sex, and commerce. The Hindus have an excellent teaching here. If what is to be said is truthful, kind, and useful, then say it. If it is not, silence is best. Saint Teresa wrote in that marvelous book of hers, The Interior Castle, "How can your tongues be better employed when you are together than in praising God, who has given us so much cause for it?" The Buddha strenuously upheld the Aryan silence. If speech there must be, he said, let it deal with the Dhamma or with the living of the holy life. In the celebration of the Christian Eucharist, there is this beautiful passage spoken by the deacon. "Cleanse my heart and my lips, O God, who by the hand of thy seraph didst cleanse the lips of thy prophet Isaiah with a burning coal from thy altar. And in thy loving kindness, so purify me that I may worthily proclaim thy holy gospel." So speaks the Christian. Several centuries before Jesus, whilst sitting under the Ajapala tree after the Enlightenment, the Buddha answers a Brahmin's question as to what makes a Brahmin teacher with these words: "That Brahman who bars out all evil, who is pure and selfless, who is master of the Vedas and lives the holy life, he is one who may rightly preach the Brahma word," that is, the Buddha Dhamma, the Buddhist gospel. Let us conclude with a passage from the Heart of Religion. Seek out the way, your own unique way through mindfulness, the way of everlasting life, of sweet savor, without a moment of stagnation. Mindfulness reveals that some of the most serious blocks are our own beliefs, especially our religious beliefs. Deep distress comes when cherished beliefs are seen to be illusions, tacit assumptions to be groundless, and preconceptions to be unwarranted. One is most reluctant to relinquish the familiar intellectual and spiritual landscape, terrified to turn one's back upon what seems safe ground and wing an uncharted flight into the trackless open. And this open seems to be nothing but an all-devouring emptiness, for all the hitherto familiar meaningfulness has vanished, and there is not a sign in the heavens or in the earth to give a single indication of anything. There is but the vast solitude of the nothing. The wings of the spirit are truly terrible, an invisible fire scorching every resource, a freezing chill petrifying head and heart and hand into immobility. Now is the moment. Let go of everything: self, God, master, values, knowledge, everything. Let them go absolutely, for now is the moment of the no thing. The whole of ever-dying time is not equal to this instant of poised eternity. It hurts, even as you were hurt when you were squeezed out of your mother's womb. And it hurts enough to wring out tears from the eyes of the soul. But tears must flow and wash away all vision-obscuring dust.